is currently professor at large at Moody Bible Institute. Dr. Dyer hosts the program The Land and the Book on Moody and Dr. Dyer is the associate pastor at Grace Bible Church in San Diego. We are excited to hear what you have to say. Thank you.
Thanks. It's great to be with you. The only correction I'd make on that is call me Charlie. Anything else I hear, I get nervous. But I do want to jump right in, starting with prayer, and then we'll start taking a look at the ISIS crisis and what's been happening. But let's go to the Lord in prayer. Father, thanks for the day. Thank you for the beautiful weather. Thank you for the fellowship we have and for the freedom we have to gather together and study your word and learn more about you. I pray now, give me wisdom as I speak. Help me to make not just current events, but especially your word clear. And give each person here the ability to hear and absorb and apply the truth to their lives. May we all leave here more in love with you than we were when we came in. We ask it all in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.
Well, what I want to do is cover the ISIS crisis. And I'll tell you what every Christian needs to know. Now, I was here a couple of years ago. In fact, it's interesting, when we wrote, my co-author and I wrote this book, ISIS was just breaking on the world scene, and our twofold message was, one, don't get overly fearful of ISIS, because everybody became so afraid. And the second point was, realize there's something worse than ISIS, and it's coming. And so that's what we're going to talk about, both of those today. But I need to give you the perspective on ISIS, and I try and boil it down to this. Four facts you need to know. And fact number one when it came to ISIS is Islam is at the center of the problem. In 2015, the last year they had statistics, there were over 12,000 terrorist attacks worldwide. Most of those attacks were in Muslim countries. Most were carried out by Muslims, and most were against Muslims. 28,000 people were killed that year. We don't hear about them all because our media focuses more inward. Western Europe we hear about, the United States we hear about. We don't hear about all the other attacks elsewhere, but there's a lot going on. But what we do know is if we want to solve a problem, the first thing you got to do is identify the right cause or causes. If we don't understand the problem, we'll never come up with the right solution. And the reason I say that is, point number one, Islam is at the heart of the problem. Here's why I think we've had such a difficult time in our country resolving it. It doesn't matter what your political affiliation. I want to give you two quotes. First, President Bush, he said, "The face of terror is not the true face of Islam." That's not what Islam's all about. Islam's peace. These terrorists don't represent peace. They represent evil and war. Well, actually, they represent very closely what Muhammad taught. The other side of the spectrum, President Obama said, when he's talking about ISIS, are not religious leaders. They're terrorists. We're not at war with Islam. We're at war with people who perverted Islam. No religion's responsible for terrorism. People are responsible for violence and terrorism. Well, that's true, except al-Baghdadi, the head of ISIS, happens to have his doctorate in Islamic studies. One of the most prestigious universities. He can speak on Islam and do better than most Muslims can in defining what Muhammad indeed taught. So no matter which side you go on, Islam really is part of it. Now, don't confuse Islam with Muslims. Most Muslims don't know what the Quran teaches. Most Muslims are Muslim the way most Christians are Christian. They were born that way. They're socially... family-wise, but they don't know that much. Most Muslims are wonderful people. So I'm not speaking against Muslims, but I'm saying Islam, at least what Muhammad taught, what the Quran taught, really is part of the problem that was behind and fueling ISIS. To give an example why understanding that makes so much sense, if you don't get it, you come up with something like this. You remember the Pulse nightclub massacre? It takes place. And then at the time, Vice President Biden said, "We're closely monitoring, fully involved in the investigation of the country's worst mass shooting. The violence is not normal. Targeting our lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender Americans is evil and abhorrent." Well, it wasn't about shootings, and it wasn't about the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender. It was a Muslim. who did this in the name of ISIS. So it wasn't gun violence, it wasn't LGBT, it was Islam, ultimately, at the center of the conflict. Since that time, what's happened? You may remember, October 31, 2015, ISIS attacked in Sinai. They brought down a Soviet airplane, and everybody on board was killed, all 224. November 9, 2015, ISIS had multiple attacks in Paris, especially at the nightclub. 130 were killed, hundreds were wounded in that attack. It came to December of 2015. ISIS attacked San Bernardino, California. We had 14 killed, 22 wounded in that attack. He finally came into 2016. In January 12th, they bombed the Blue Mosque. If any of you have ever visited Istanbul, you may have stood in line right where they were. I have a picture right at the spot where that bomb went off. It was deliberately designed to target the tourists that were there. The death toll, it said, was 10. It ultimately rose to 13 in that attack. March of 2016, there's an attack in Brussels at the airport. It killed 35. It wounded over 300. In that attack. It came back to Turkey in June of 2016. Another attack at the Istanbul airport. This time, 44 were killed. Hundreds were wounded in that attack. You come to July of 2016. It gets kind of repetitious, doesn't it? ISIS attack in Nice, France. And 84 were killed. Hundreds were wounded in that attack as they drove down the roadway, just knocking off the pedestrians. Finally come to Christmas, and you have the attack in Germany on the Christmas market in Berlin. Same kind of thing, a truck driven into the crowd. 12 were killed in that attack. You come into this year, 2017, January 1st, an ISIS supporter opens fire on an Istanbul nightclub. 39 were killed in that attack. March of this year, ISIS supporter runs down pedestrians in the heart of London. And then stabbed a police officer to death. 6 were killed in that attack. 49 were injured. May of this year, ISIS supporters set up a bomb that killed 22 children attending a concert in Manchester. Hundreds were wounded in that attack. June of this year, ISIS supporters killed 8 people and critically injured 21 on London Bridge. And if I can add one more, I didn't put a slide in. Just what, 2 weeks ago now, the bombing on a train in London. By the way, my daughter lives in London, lives in Wimbledon, and was one train ahead of the one that was bombed. Two stations forward, they shut the line down, and she had to get off and find another way to work. It's taking place. It's moving into Europe. Those attacks we hear. Most of the others we don't. But the one commonality in all of these attacks was they were ISIS-inspired or ISIS-developed, ISIS-led. But I come back to this question. Islam's at the center of the problem. And what most of us don't understand is Islam itself. There's a divide within Islam between the Sunnis and the Shiites. It began right at the death of Muhammad. Much of the violence that's taking place, especially with ISIS, is not just they're attacking the West. They're attacking the Shiites that they view as apostate Muslims. It's definitely a religious war between the Sunnis and the Shiites. I'll put up a map of the Middle East just to show you how this works. Here's a map of the Middle East. We think that all is Muslim. But if you subdivide, the dark green is where the Shiites are. Iran is Shiite. The southern part of Iraq is Shiite. In fact, Iraq now, the government, is Shiite dominated. The southern part of Lebanon, it's not quite as clear there, but Hezbollah is Shiite. In the north western part of Syria, in the very section of Turkey there, is Shiite. All the light green area are the Sunnis. If you follow what's been happening in the Middle East, in Syria, the rebellion against Assad is he controls Syria. He is not a light. That's an offshoot of the Shiites. The majority of the country are Sunnis. It was a Sunni-Shiite conflict, and ISIS took advantage of that. In essence, people supported ISIS because they were helping to get rid of the Alawites, the minority government ruling over them. In Iraq, once the Shiites took over, it's northern Iraq where the Sunnis live and supported ISIS. Much of ISIS's support is the Sunnis against the Shiites that's taking place. Muslim hatred toward not just fellow Muslims, but toward Jews and Christians began long before the state of Israel, long before the Crusades. Because you'll hear people say, well, the problem is the Crusades. That's why they don't like Christians. Well, that was a problem, but that's not why they don't like Christians. Or the problem is the state of Israel. If Israel hadn't been formed, there wouldn't be a problem with the Jews and Muslims' hatred toward the Jews. Neither of those are true statements. How do we know that? You go to their own book. The Quran is the Bible. Hadith are sayings that early Muslims said. This is, I heard Muhammad say this. And the Hadith are the sayings about Muhammad. They don't have quite the authority of the Quran, but they are still revered. One of the most common statements cited from the Hadith, the last hour, that is the end of time, will not come unless the Muslims will fight against the Jews and the Muslims will kill them until the Jews would hide themselves behind a stone or a tree. And the stone or tree itself will say, hey, Muslim, the servant of Allah, there's a Jew behind you. Now come and kill him. Well, that's long before the state of Israel. That's attributed to Muhammad right after his death. You have this verse in the Quran. Fight those who believe not in Allah, nor the last day, nor hold that which has been forbidden by Allah and his messenger, nor acknowledge the religion of truth. That is, you're to fight everyone who doesn't accept Muhammad as the prophet, the Quran as his book, and Allah as the only God. You're supposed to do that even if they're people of the book. Well, that's what the Muslims refer to as Christians and Jews. So it doesn't matter if they're Christians, Jews, if they don't acknowledge Muhammad and Allah, you're to fight them until they pay the jizya, that is the money, the tax that's put on the unbelievers by non-Muslims, or on non-Muslims. And they pay it with willing submission and feel themselves subdued. So until you're willing to admit, yes, you're in charge, the Muslims are to fight you. And that's from the Quran. You get even earlier, from World War II. Most people don't know that the Haj Amin al-Hussein, he was the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, was a supporter of Hitler. Actually appeared on German radio, and one of his broadcasts said, "Arise, O sons of Arabia, fight for your sacred rights, slaughter Jews wherever you find them. Their spilled blood pleases Allah, our history, and religion. That will save our honor." So what Hitler was doing in Germany, Haj Amin al-Husseini was calling on Muslims everywhere to do in the Middle East and elsewhere. That is, kill the Jews wherever you find them. That's before there was a state of Israel. Again, Islam is at the center of it. Muslims fighting Muslims, but they also have a fight against the Christians and the Jews. That was fact number one. Fact number two, the current Middle East crisis, if you want to understand it, you need to understand World War One. Sadly, today, in our generation, the Vietnam War is ancient history for most Americans. World War Two, we tend to understand that one a little more. World War One is really the Dark Ages for most people. But you need to understand World War One and what was happening if you want to understand the Middle East today. In fact, I'll briefly summarize it into three things. There were three major agreements that were made in World War One. The first was a promise to the Arabs. How many of you have seen the movie Lawrence of Arabia? We love the cinematography of it. But if you realize what was happening is the British were fighting the Germans and the Austrians and the Ottomans, the Turks. They were trying to get the Arabs on their side to rebel against the Ottomans. And as the British, as Lawrence, and he really was a historical character, they kind of over-dramatized it in the movie, but basically he did do all the things that were pictured in that movie. The British came to the Arabs and said, I'll tell you what, if you follow us, if you join us in rebellion against the Ottomans, we're going to give you your country. We'll give you what the Ottomans have never given you. Here's the statement they said. I am empowered in the name of the government of Great Britain to give the following assurance, make the following reply to your letter. He's writing this, by the way, to Abdullah al-Hussein, the Sharif of Mecca. He says, Great Britain, subject to the above modifications, Great Britain is prepared to recognize and support the independence of the Arabs within the territories in the limits and boundaries proposed by the Sharif of Mecca. We will give you your country, the boundaries you propose, if you help us fight the Ottomans and drive them out. Now, if you're an Arab, that sounds pretty good. If you help us, we'll help you, and you'll have your country. That's the first promise that the British and French made. The second promise was to the Jews. In fact, we're coming up October 31st this year is Halloween. October 31st is the 500th anniversary of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses on the Wittenberg door. October 31st is also the 100th anniversary of the promise that was made to the Jewish people. It was actually printed a few days later, but the cabinet voted on it on October 31st, and here's what they said. His Majesty's government viewed with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and we used our best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object. It being clearly understood that nothing should be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in other countries. So all those things kind of have that small print in them. But basically they said, His Majesty's government looks with favor on the establishment of a state that will ultimately be called Israel. Now, yes, we know that. Okay, well imagine if I have a house for sale in Scottsdale and I sell you the house in Scottsdale. But I also sell you the house in Scottsdale. And you both show up to claim the house that I sold you. We have a problem. The British and the French made promises to the Arabs saying, we will give you this country. Well, the Sharif of Mecca knew what he wanted. And it included all three of the major shrines in Islam, Jerusalem, Mecca, Medina, and all of the Muslim territory, the Arab-speaking territory. The Jewish people knew what they wanted, and their understanding was from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean, the land that was historically the nation of Israel is going to be back and be our land. Those two are the same thing. That's a problem. But the British and French didn't see a problem with it all because there was a third agreement. It was the agreement they made with each other. And the British and French had a secret agreement called the Sykes-Picot Agreement. In fact, it wasn't ever intended to be published. When Russia withdrew from their alliance and became communist, the communists, the Bolsheviks, published the Sykes-Picot Agreement and created a bit of embarrassment. The Sykes-Picot Agreement basically said, when this all is done, here's how we're going to split up the Middle East. We're going to put a major line. You see on this map kind of the blue on top, orange toward the bottom, and there's a blue letter A and an orange letter B. The A, the top part of the map, as they drew the line, they said to the French, this will be your land. Now, the solid blue, you can just keep that. That's yours. Why would they want that? Well, there was some potential for oil in that region. Where the letter A is, we'll create an Arab country there, but it's really going to be a puppet government. You'll run it. The B, the solid orange area, was going to be Britain's. They were just going to keep it. What's down there? Oil. The British Navy, which ruled the world at the time, had converted from coal to oil. They needed the oil. There it is. We'll keep it. Oh, and we'll create a country in that area called B, but it'll be a puppet government and we'll run it. How influential were they? Well, if you ever go to the Middle East, if you happen to go to Lebanon or Syria and didn't speak Arabic, the language next to Arabic that's spoken most in those countries is French, because the French took it over. If you went to Iraq or Jordan or Saudi Arabia, and next to Arabic, the language spoken most is English, because the British were controlling that area. You may have always wondered, how did they get such nice, neat, straight lines in dividing countries, like the boundary between Syria and Iraq, Syria and Jordan, or Jordan and Iraq, or Iraq and Saudi Arabia? The British and French sat down with a map and a ruler and just drew boundaries. Those boundaries didn't take into account the religious divisions between them, between the Shiites and the Sunnis. It didn't take into account the ethnic divisions between the Kurds or the other ethnic groups that are there. And the problem that they created has been with us till today. In fact, even today, if you're following what's happening with the Kurdish vote for independence, the largest ethnic group in the world that's never been given its own country are the Kurds. This map divided them up between Iraq, Syria, Turkey, and Iran. And the Kurds have been fighting for their own country ever since. One fellow who was attending the peace conferences afterward, I loved his quote, Field Marshal Archibald Wavell, said, after the war to end war, they seem to have been pretty successful in Paris at making a peace to end peace. And they have. That's where the modern Middle East crisis came from, were those three agreements, especially that third one. Yes?
Charlie, question on, if you go back one slide.
Yes.
What was going to happen if Russia and the Turks had won the war. Had they made a pass?
In fact, it was still the Ottoman Empire, so it would have been, it would have stayed the Ottoman Empire. And one example within Iraq itself, the Ottomans, what we call the country of Iraq, never existed historically like that. In the Ottoman Empire, the country of Iraq had three provinces by its three major cities. The Shiites were down in Basra to the south. The Sunnis were centered around Baghdad in the center. And Mosul, which ISIS controlled, was where the Kurdish area was. The Turks had three provinces, and they just intended to keep ruling it as they had been before. So it was really the British and the French who decided, we'll carve it up in a special way so that we can get the influence on the oil.
So in a weird way, the Arabs, even though it's not good, the solution, it was way better than the option of Russia and the Turks.
Well, in one sense, although the Turks were harsh, but at least they understood that the Kurds and the Shiites, the Sunnis, they understood that the difference in the provinces, you basically resolve the ethnic and religious tensions if you give them their self-rule. So in one sense, they had less problems in the area than before. It's just that the British promised absolute freedom, and if you're a subject of anybody, freedom sounds better than that. Sadly, what they got in the end was more turmoil. Okay, four key facts. Fact number two was the current Middle East crisis began in World War I. Let's go to fact number three, the roots of ISIS. If you want to know where ISIS came from, you've got to know a little bit more history, and you've got to go all the way back to the Russian invasion of Afghanistan in 1979. You have to remember that year. That was the year my son was born. So I can remember 1979 pretty well, but 1979 was not a good year in the world. Several things happened. You may remember Three Mile Island. That's the Susquehanna River, and I lived just up the Susquehanna River from there. So I remember Three Mile Island quite well. 1979 was the year that Khomeini took over in Iran and threw over the Shah of Iran and set up the Islamic Republic that has been a problem since. 1979 is the year of U.S. hostage crisis. What was it? 444 days that crisis lasted, and it began in 1979 when they took over the U.S. embassy there in Tehran. The part we tend to forget is at the end of the year, in December, that was also the year that Russia invaded Afghanistan. And the Russian army rolled in, and it scared the United States. We had just very recently pulled out of Vietnam. We were watching the communists take over, like dominoes falling, and suddenly Russia's moving into the Middle East. It was great fear. You know, could they use that as a launching pad to continue on? And if Russia had gone into the rest of the Middle East, including Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, we were in deep trouble because we had just gone through an energy crisis. We realized how dependent we were on oil. Russia is now threatening the oil fields. It was a very difficult time in our life. That said, that event is what led. You have to kind of connect the dots, but that's what led ultimately to ISIS. And you go, okay, how did that work? Well, dot number one were the Afghanistan Mujahideen. The U.S., we don't have large support there. Jimmy Carter helps authorize the supply of the Iraq, we call them the Afghan Freedom Fighters. That's what they were called in our press. This ragged band of local soldiers who were standing against the Soviet army. And we supplied them with weaponry. Now, by the way, here's the ragged band. That is what the Mujahideen looked like, the Afghan Freedom Fighters, as we called them. We supplied them with anti-aircraft Stinger missiles. We supplied them with some of the most sophisticated weaponry we could have. Did any of you see the movie Charlie Wilson's War? Okay, well, this is the original Charlie Wilson. Lufkin, Texas, Democrat from Lufkin, Texas. Charlie Wilson helped get the CIA to funnel billions of dollars in to support the Afghan freedom fighters, but the Afghan Mujahideen. In the middle of it all, you probably never read anything, because I never did either. Mujahideen, look at what's in the middle of that phrase. It comes from the word jihad. The Mujahideen were Islamic fighters raised up because the infidels have invaded our land, were rising up to fight the infidels. And that's what they did. That war bled the Soviet Union. It actually was one of the major reasons the Soviet Union collapsed. There were several reasons, but one of the major reasons for the collapse was their version of a Vietnam. They got stuck in a quagmire, and it created a great dissension at home, bled them dry, and led to their problems. Now, the Russians pull out finally. They get rid of Afghanistan. And what did the U.S. do? We pulled out too. We didn't care anymore. I mean, who cares about Afghanistan? We plowed millions and billions of dollars in to fund the Mujahideen. And when the war was over, we kind of left them. And we left this country that was an absolute basket case, but flooded with weaponry that we had helped supply. And it ended up developing into a series of warlords. The country began fighting at one another. And that leads to the second dot that came along. Dot number two were the Taliban. As the war fighting continued, one warlord, Sheikh Omar, began dominating the others. And he said, we're going to impose an Islamic state on Afghanistan. We're going to unite this country, and we're going to unite it under Islamic law. Now, here's what the Taliban look like. Muhammad Omar is their one. By the way, the word Taliban comes from the word for student. And it was meaning a student of Islam. He had helped train them not only in how to fight, but he was teaching them what the Quran taught. And so they became the students of Islam. They became the fighters. They united Afghanistan. Well, what happened? Well, they imposed Sharia law. Afghanistan became the land of the blue burqas. That was the time when they blew up the statues of Buddha. They remembered that. It's when they forbade women from going to school. They were expelled from schools because they don't need to learn. They women became chattel in the country. It was an incredibly difficult time. Go back and read our press. We were railing against that, these awful people. But we were the ones who helped create them. We just didn't mention that part. But the Taliban were in charge of Afghanistan. In fact, that leads to the third dot. The third dot in this connection is Al-Qaeda. And when we think of Al-Qaeda, one person comes to mind. It's Osama bin Laden. Osama bin Laden had gone to Afghanistan from Saudi Arabia to help fight the Soviets. Osama bin Laden pledged his loyalty to Muhammad Omar. In Islam, it's very important if you pledge loyalty to someone. That's your honor-bound oath. And he pledged his loyalty to the head of the Taliban. Ultimately, he comes from that perspective. Now, I'm gonna leave this picture for a second. When we think of Osama bin Laden, we jump right to 9/11. But if you go back, there's a lot that happens in between. Osama bin Laden was in Afghanistan. The Taliban, when he goes home to Saudi Arabia, that's like 1989, the Soviets pull out of Afghanistan. 1991, the United States goes into Saudi Arabia. Hey, wait a minute, you didn't tell the whole story. That was when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, and he threatened Saudi Arabia, and the United States went in to help protect Saudi Arabia and to drive Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait, right? Now, picture it from his perspective. I just fought to get the infidels out of Afghanistan, and now the infidels are in Saudi Arabia, the land of the two mosques, the two holiest sites of Islam, and the U.S. is there. We got to get rid of them. And so Osama bin Laden began to building up his group. By the way, the word Al-Qaeda in Arabic means the base. Right? Like you said, if you build an army base, he built a base in Afghanistan. And that's just how he named his group after that place. It's got a less than ideal name, but it's the base. Well, he builds his base of support, and their goal is to drive Americans out of Saudi Arabia. Yes?
Charlie, is Al-Qaeda and the Sharia people and all those different things, are they all the same
group under ISIS? No. In fact, that's ISIS is still to come. It's going to develop out of these. But the one thing they share in common is they are saying, this is what Islam teaches. We need to go back to the basics of Islam. So they're an Islamic fundamentalist movement that's saying this is the way Muhammad said the area that's controlled by Muslims ought to be ruled. Within the groups, the Taliban, the Afghan freedom fighters were trying to drive the Soviets out. Out of them, the Taliban said we need to establish that kind of rule. Osama bin Laden agreed with the same principles. That's why he pledged loyalty. So Al-Qaeda had the same principles. I think the slight difference for him is he's saying, The first thing we need to do is get rid of the West. We need to drive the West out of the Middle East, and then we can establish that kind of rule, not just in Afghanistan, but in Saudi Arabia and in all these other countries.
So these attacks that are going on around the world today, they're not necessarily one group. I mean, they call them ISIS, but
it can be multiple. Yeah, Al-Qaeda is still operative, so you have Al-Qaeda and ISIS actually competing with each other for personnel and resources. Even today, yeah. Which and there's even within Syria, there were over 20 different independent Islamic groups, all sharing the same basic goals, but the tactics and the methods that they were going to use were different. So Osama bin Laden, by the way, his he had a number of attacks. Most of us don't remember the bombing of the U.S. embassies in Africa. They were Al Qaeda. They attacked. We remember the attack on the USS Cole, where they blew up. The USS the Sullivans was attacked that same year earlier. Same technique. They loaded up a dinghy with explosives. They were going to run against the ship. They put too many explosives in, and the dinghy sank. And so what they did is they figured that out. They modified and did it again, and it was successful. The final attack is what we remember, is when they attacked the World Trade Center. And that's when they jumped on our consciousness. But they were there. From the early 90s, trying to attack Americans. I saw a hand back here. Yes?
Yes. I just missed one point you were making, trying to understand. So in 1989, when the Soviets pulled out, which was it that Bin Laden and the rest of them upset? Was the U.S. coming?
Oh, not, no. In fact, 89, Bin Laden goes back home from Afghanistan to Saudi Arabia. 2 years later, when the U.S. enters Saudi Arabia, we would say to drive Saddam Hussein. We had to have a place to launch our attack to drive him out of Kuwait. But from Osama bin Laden's perspective, this is even worse than what I was fighting before. Rather than the Soviets were bad enough in Afghanistan, but to have another Western crusader power in Mecca and Medina is horrible. We got to fight that, and that's what motivated him and pushed him on. Well, he attacks the World Trade Center, and suddenly, you know, we're now following them. We're going to attack them, and we definitely did. And we drove Osama bin Laden underground. We didn't quite capture him, but that's what leads to the next dot. If I connect it, Al Qaeda has to change. We're after them. We're attacking Al Qaeda. We're again forcing bin Laden into hiding for all those years. And Al Qaeda has to change somehow. And they actually went into for lack of a better term, they went into the franchise mode. Al Qaeda was still bin Laden, but his second in command, Al-Zawahiri, is going to be the kind of the front. He's going to be more speaking. But they're sending out secret messages, and they decide to form Al Qaeda in Iraq, Al Qaeda in Syria. Sometimes you have QIP, AQIP. It's the Al Qaeda Arabian Peninsula sound in Yemen. They formed separate groups under that head. Again, it's like McDonald's, the corporate headquarters. That's Osama bin Laden. But you have all the local franchisees, and that's all these different countries. So again, the guy who's the man you start seeing is Zawahiri. In fact, after bin Laden is killed, he's still the head of Al Qaeda. He doesn't have the stature of bin Laden, and that's why you've not heard as much about Al Qaeda. But he began running it. He's the one who set up these franchise models. And so the different countries had their own al-Qaeda, supposedly getting their overall direction from the leadership, but then running their own program in their own country anyway. Well, of all these franchises, the one that was the most successful was the franchise in Iraq, in northern Iraq. The U.S. had invaded Iraq. This is about the time of the Second Gulf War. We're in Iraq, and we start seeing all of the rise of the terrorism against the U.S. soldiers, if you remember all of that. It was done by this franchise, and the guy who was the head of the franchise of al-Qaeda in Iraq is called al-Zarqawi. Quite, you can't tell these people apart without the program, can you? Because all the names start sounding alike. All you need to remember is this guy came up with two things. He decided al-Qaeda... We need to change how it's going to happen. We're going to attack the West. We're going to attack the soldiers. And we're going to attack the Shiites. They're Sunni. Al-Qaeda, ISIS, all of them are Sunni Muslims. He says, look, we all know that the Shiites are apostates. They're not true Muslims. We ought to get rid of them. And so he starts attacking the Shiites in Iraq and the Westerners in Iraq. The other thing he started doing is he said, we need to instill fear in people. Let's go back and do what Muhammad did originally. Let's start having some rather gruesome executions. The first beheading of a Westerner was done personally by him against one of the workers that was captured in Iraq. So public beheadings and gruesome executions were begun by Zarqawi. Al-Qaeda in Iraq became this model of gruesomeness on Islam. It was as gruesome as what Muhammad himself had done. In fact, he became so successful that he decided we're gonna have a corporate merger, and Al-Qaeda in Iraq is going to merge with Al-Qaeda in Syria. The problem is he didn't ask corporate headquarters if that was okay. And so the head of Al-Qaeda said, in fact, wrote letters that you can't do that. We're not going to allow that. You're in Iraq, but you can't be in Syria. Zarqawi said, that's no problem. I got ahead of myself. Zarqawi gets killed right in the middle of all that, and another guy takes over, al-Baghdadi. And finally come down. Now here's where ISIS shows up. Al-Baghdadi takes over from Zarqawi. He's as successful as Zarqawi was. He's against Baghdadi, who says, we're going to unite. We're going to combine with Syria. When he's told no, he says, fine, we're starting our own group. We're going to start the caliphate. We're going to start what Muhammad ultimately said. We're going to have the Islamic Empire, and I'm the head of it. And so suddenly this guy shows up and says, I'm the head, I'm the caliph, and we're on our way. And the world pretty much didn't pay any attention until 2014. And that was when Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi took over Mosul, the second largest city in Iraq. Actually, he only had a few thousand soldiers. He took over from an Iraqi army that had, they estimated, like 25,000 soldiers. And when he attacked with such ferocity, they just threw down their weapons and ran. So he not only took over Mosul, he got some of the best U.S.-made weapons that we had given to the Iraqi army at that point. And he burst on the world scene, and suddenly everybody's afraid. There's nothing that can stop him. Oh, isn't it terrible? Well, that was 3 years ago. Today, it's Al-Qaeda, sorry, it's ISIS that's on the run. They've lost most of their territory, not all. They've lost most of their territory. And people who were overly afraid in 2014 are actually becoming quite complacent in 2017, and both extremes are wrong. ISIS is still dangerous. In fact, to the extent that they've been driven from their territory, the estimate is upwards of 20 to 25,000 fighters who had come from the West, come from Europe, come from other countries, including the Chechnya region and North Africa, to fight for ISIS. Many of them have now gone home with the incredible training and still committed to the cause of ISIS. So as their territory declines, the expectation is we should see more of the kind of attacks we've been seeing, and certainly they seem to have been multiplying recently in the West. The U.S. has been relatively unscathed. That's not necessarily going to stay true in the future, but much of it's certainly happening in Europe, Western Europe. And what we're seeing there is where ISIS is morphing. They've become an ultra successful, brutal terrorist organization that's now scattered around much of the world. And he's the guy who did it. I remember when it was that when they started marching through the towns carrying those black banners that the world took notice. It's when they began doing the public executions, first beheadings, then they burned people alive, they drowned them alive, they looked for new ways. What made ISIS so unique was they attacked the Sunni, the Shiites and the West. But they also had some of the most slick PR the world's ever seen. They began using social media. They began producing their own slick online magazine. They used all of the Western techniques to promote what they were doing and to try and build a new generation of Muslims to follow them. And that's why they were so successful in recruiting people to their cause. I got to keep watching my time here, so let me move point out point three. Point four, as bad as ISIS is, there's something worse than ISIS that's going to be out there. There's a far greater threat than ISIS that looms on the horizon. And again, 3 years ago, this is what we were saying and people didn't hear. I think now you'll hear it and it will make a lot more sense. And it starts with the question, what could be more dangerous or deadly than ISIS? well, back in 2015, one of our generals, when he was at a Senate confirmation hearing, made an assertion. I think he was right on. He said, my assessment is Russia poses the greatest threat to our national security. And if you look at their behavior, it's nothing short of alarming. And I'm not referring to Russia's meddling in our elections. This is 2015. It's not 2016, the election process. Russia was already starting to see what it could do in the Middle East at that time. Here's some examples on me. Reports of Russian buildup in Syria. I just pulled headlines out of the papers over a period of time. Russia shipping tanks into Syria. Russian submarines and ICBMs were off the coast of Syria. NATO worried about alleged Russian military buildup in Syria. Suddenly, Russia moved into Syria. If you remember, Assad was on the ropes. The U.S. coalition we built up with Saudi Arabian support was almost ready to overthrow Assad. Russia stepped in, and Assad's going to stay in power. And the coalition that we built has fractured and fallen apart. Russia single-handedly changed the course of Syrian history. And not just Syria, but also what's happening in Iraq. It was their buildup in Syria that made that difference. Examples of it. If suddenly Putin was the most popular man in Syria, he angered the U.S. with airstrikes on Syrian rebels. He began attacking our rebels. He said he was going into Syria to fight ISIS. But about 90% of the airstrikes happened to be against our allies, not against the ISIS. He changed the course of things, and we didn't stop it. I don't know how we could have, but we certainly didn't, and he showed that he was the influencer in the Middle East. Not just in not just in Syria, though. If you look what's happening in Iran, Russia and Iran discuss increasing military ties. Russia has sold Iran some of its most sophisticated anti-aircraft weapons that are available. Russia has been meeting with the head of Iran. CNN, growing alliance between Russia and Iran. And, of course, the S-300, S-400 anti-aircraft missile system. The U.S. was threatening Iran, but Russia has made it much more difficult for us to ever double down on the threat. If we said to Iran, if you back away from an agreement, we'll destroy your nuclear facilities, they're now protected by some of the most sophisticated weaponry the world's ever seen, thanks to Russia. Russia's given much of the other help that Iran has needed. Russia's alliance is with Iran, and it's emboldened the Iranians. Russia in Syria, Russia in Iran. The other place that you're watching Russia today is Turkey. And again, I just throw up headlines that are showing up. Erdogan is there. The Turkish foreign minister has visited Russia. Russia, by the way, has just broken NATO in the sense that NATO has always bought NATO equipment. Turkey's a member of NATO. Turkey just agreed to buy Russia's anti-aircraft system, not a Western system. Turkey has been moving closer to Russia with trade deals and other deals and military. In fact, in the last year, it's grown even closer. And sadly, it's happened because of the failed coup in Turkey. Remember about a year ago? They had the coup in Turkey. Erdogan crushed it. There's a real question on it. But what I find it absolutely interesting is that Erdogan has now become almost a dictator. He's almost like the Ottoman Empire again, and that's what he's trying to establish. But as he does, here's the part that I found interesting. Turkey is now saying, you know who was responsible for that coup? It was the U.S. U.S. Commander Campbell, the man behind the failed coup in Turkey. That's from a Turkish newspaper. They put up other imagery of it. To me, it's absolutely amazing. The Turkey is moving toward more dependence on Russia. They were historic enemies, but now they're much more closely allied. Okay, Russia is influencing the Middle East. Russia is influencing Syria. Russia is influencing Iran. Russia is influencing Turkey. So what difference does all this make? And that's where the few minutes I had, I wanted to take you to the Bible.
Yeah.
Because that's where we find the pattern for everything. And if you have your Bible, it's Ezekiel 38 is where I want to go. Because Ezekiel 38 and 39, I think, puts the Middle East puzzle together. Ezekiel describes a battle. From the day he wrote until today, this battle has never happened. He describes it in very precise detail. And so let me start. The word of the Lord came to me, saying, he said in 38:1 and verse 2 of chapter 38, Son of man, set your face toward God of the land of Magog, the prince or chief prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal, and prophesy against him. Ezekiel's told to prophesy against someone. The name God throws us off. Who in the world is God? Well, 75 years before Ezekiel wrote this, there was a guy in the Middle East, lived in the Turkey area, named Diges. He was the Adolf Hitler of his day. He was just absolutely ruthless. He turned against people. He broke alliances. He expanded his power. And finally was done away. Can you imagine if someone rose today and said, set your face toward the next Hitler and prophesy against him? We would understand exactly what he's saying. Because that name conjures up an image. The name Gyges or God conjured up an image in Ezekiel's day. There's going to be a ruthless individual rise up, and he's going to be there. And it says he's going to be a ruthless individual. Here's where he's going to rule. The chief prince of Meshach, Tubal, and say to the thus says the Lord God, I'm against you, O God, either prince of Rosh, or the word Rosh means head, so to be head prince of Meshach and Tubal, and I'll turn you about, put hooks in your jaws, and bring you out, and all your army, horses, horsemen, all of them splendidly attired, a great company with buckler and shield, all of them wielding swords, an army from the north. Now, so where is this alliance? Well, here's the Middle East. You can see where the Black Sea is, the Mediterranean Sea. Magog, this place is mentioned, was north of the Black Sea. It was there in Ezekiel's day. If they had a map, you could find it on a map. It was north of the Black Sea. He was also the head of Meshach, he said, and Tubal. Those are between the Black and Caspian Seas. Ezekiel comes along and says, hey, this ruler who's going to rise up is from this area. But he's coming with allies. Verse 5, Persia, Ethiopia, and Put will be with them. This guy's coming from the north, but his allies are Persia, Cush, and Put. Would be what the Bible would have. Persia, we know. Persia was the country that was east of the Babylonian Empire. It was the Medo-Persian Empire. In Ezekiel's day, Daniel mentions it. It's the modern country of Iran. In Iran, they don't speak Arabic. They speak Farsi, which is the word for Persian. Persia was Iran. Cush and Put, these other countries, Cush or Ethiopia, but was it the land south of Egypt. Today it's the area where Sudan is. Put was the land to the west of Egypt. It's the area today where Libya is. Ezekiel comes along and says, a guy from the far north is coming down with his army. He has allies that are from the east and the south and the west. Now, he mentions a few more. He says, as he goes on, verse 6, Gomer with all his troops. Beth Togarma from the remote parts of the north with all his troops. Many people with you. Gomer was also in that Black Caspian Sea area, the Caucasus region. And Togarma, Beth Togarma means House of Togarma. That was the region in the Anatolian Peninsula. That's where Turkey is today. Ezekiel comes along and says, this man from the far north with his armies has a group of allies that are also some from the north, but also from the east, south, and west. And all those armies together are going to be gathered. And as he comes along and describes it, he says, they're actually going to come against Israel. In fact, verse 7, be prepared. Prepare yourself, you and all your companies that are assembled about you, and be a guard for them. After many days, you'll be summoned. In the latter years, you'll come into the land that is restored from the sword, whose inhabitants have been gathered from many nations to the mountains of Israel, which have been a continued waste, but its people were brought out from the nations, and they are all living securely, all of them. He says, you're going to attack the land of Israel. A nation that had been scattered is now brought back to the land and is living in security. Again, from the day Ezekiel wrote this, when he wrote it, Israel was in captivity. They came back, but they were never in safety. They were being ruled by others, and there's never been an attack by these nations. But he comes along, and he describes this attack coming against Israel. Now, my time is up, but I'm going to summarize the ending. Here's the good news. Oh, okay. Good. Well, then we're going to go on to the rest of it here. But I'll stop before then, I promise you. He pictures them coming, and verse 10, thus says the Lord God, it will come about on that day, thoughts will come into your mind, and you'll devise an evil plan, and you'll say, I'm going to go up against the land of unwalled villages. I'll go against those who are at rest, that live securely, all of them living without walls, having no bars or gates, capture spoil, seize plunder, turn your hands against the waste places that are now inhabited, and against the people who are gathered from the nations and have acquired cattle, goods, who live at the center of the world. This guy, this leader says, I'm going to bring this army, and the goal is to attack Israel. Now, not everybody's sure where he's coming. In fact, verse 13, Sheba and Dedan, that happens to be the Arabian Peninsula. That's the area where Saudi Arabia is today. The merchants of Tarshish, with all its villages, say to you, hey, you come to capture spoiler, you're assembling your company to seize plunder, to carry away silver, gold, to take away cattle, goods, to capture great spoil. Are you coming against us to take what we have? And the answer is no. I have a set plan. This attack is launched against Israel. Now think of what's happening in the world today. Russia's chief allies have been building Turkey, Syria, and Iran, especially as they pull together. The Iranians have said with their goal is the destruction of Israel. They want the Jewish state eliminated. Syria hates Israel. They never made a peace treaty with Israel. They won't make a peace treaty. They want the land that is especially northern Israel. Turkey is supposedly Israel's ally. But if you follow what Erdogan has done in the last 5 years especially, he's turning against Israel. He's actually more supportive of the Hamas in Gaza than he is of the Jewish state. Russia building an alliance with all these nations coming against Israel that feels pretty secure, feels pretty safe in its land. And he says, verse 14, therefore prophesy, son of man, say to God, thus says the Lord God, on that day when my people Israel are living securely, won't you know? And you'll come from your place out of the remote parts of the north, you and many peoples with you, all of them riding horses, a great assembly and a mighty army. Now, all riding horses, you go, wait a minute. We don't ride horses today. But you have to put this in their context. If I were fighting in an army in Ezekiel's day, 99% of the army are foot soldiers. You have a shield in one hand, you have your spear or your sword in your other, and you're fighting an army that's pretty much on foot. But an army that's on mounted, either on chariots or just riding on horseback, is an army that is absolutely overwhelming to you. They can outmaneuver you. They can ride around you. They can run over you. Some armies had some parts of their army in cavalry, but most didn't. But an army that's completely in cavalry, at least it's picturing it here, and a totally armored mounted army is an army that's absolutely superior. It's overwhelming. It's an army you can't stop. And I think that's the point he's trying to make. This army, when it attacks, is going to appear absolutely overwhelmed. It's unstoppable. Israel doesn't have whatever resources it would need to stop an army of this size and this strength. Indeed, that's what he pictures. You're going to come up against my people, he says in verse 16. My people Israel like a cloud to cover the land. It'll come about in the last days, I'll bring you against my land in order that the nations may know me, but I shall be sanctified through you before their eyes, O God. The attack's coming, and God says, Israel might not be prepared, but I am. And then he describes how the army's going to be destroyed. And I'll start in verse 18. It'll come about on that day when God comes against the land of Israel, declares the Lord God. My fury will mount up in my anger, my zeal and in my blazing wrath. I'll declare that on that day there surely will be a great earthquake in the land of Israel. Now, I've been in Israel. It is getting nearer to 100 times, but I did lose count, which is nice. And I head there next Monday. But I've never been there when they've had an earthquake. But I've seen the results of what the earthquake can do. There are places where they know an earthquake that happened in 749 AD that toppled an entire city. Israel's sitting on a great rift that runs from Turkey into Africa. And about every 700 years, they have a major earthquake. They're actually overdue for one, but we kind of know what now is going to happen. It's going to happen right here. And God's going to have a massive earthquake happen as that army invades. Now, why is that a problem? Can you imagine this? He goes on and describes it. He says, verse 20, fish of the sea, the birds of the heavens, the beasts of the field, all the creeping things that creep on the earth, all the men on the face of the earth will shake at my presence. The mountains will be thrown down. The steep pathways collapse. Every wall will fall to the ground. Can you imagine the middle of an invasion that has Russia speaking Russian, Turkey that speaks Turkish, Iran that speaks Farsi, these other countries that speak Arabic. In the middle of their invasion, suddenly there's a massive earthquake and the roadways collapse. Mountains fall down, bridges collapse, walls fall over. The roadways that are coming in are suddenly impassable. And in that confusion, who do you fire at if you're in the army? Well, if I'm a Russian and in the panic, if you don't speak Russian, you are a potential enemy. I might be shooting you. We have the most sophisticated communications here in the world, and yet so many Americans in previous battles were killed by friendly fire. In the confusion of war, that happens. In this confusion of war, God's going to send a massive earthquake to disrupt the invasion. God says, I'm not done. Verse 21, I'll call for a sword against him on all my mountains, declares God. Every man's sword will be against his brother. These armies are going to start fighting one another in that confusion. The friendly fire is going to destroy him. God says, I'm not done. Verse 22, and with pestilence and with blood, I'll enter into judgment with him. Pestilence and blood, that is, there's going to be wounding, but they can't be evacuated because the roads are gone. There's going to be cholera, all the other diseases that come when the water supply and everything else is disrupted. They're not going to be able to get them out or to supply what's needed. And God says, but I'm not done. And I'm going to rain on him and on his troops, on the many people who are with him, torrential rain with hailstones. God's going to send a massive rainstorm with hailstones. By the way, there's, in the book of Joshua, Joshua 10, when Joshua rescued the Gibeonites, God sent a similar hailstones with a rainstorm. And it says more people died from the hailstones than Joshua did. If there's no buildings to hide under, nothing else, those hailstones can be deadly. I used to kind of not be sure about that. Then I lived in Texas. And there's something about seeing grapefruit-sized hail and what it can do to a car that you realize you don't want to be out in the open when something like that happens. God says, I want to do that, but I'm not done yet. He says, I'm also going to send fire and brimstone. Well, fire and burning sulfur is what God used to overthrow Sodom and Gomorrah. It's also in that region. You go to Israel. When do you go to Israel? It's God's will for you to go to Israel. But when you go and stand on the Golan Heights, you're going to see that the entire area is dotted with extinct volcanic peaks, which are not going to be extinct at that point. God's going to have a volcanic activity through that great earthquake, and suddenly this fire and brimstone is coming down. Now, if you were an insurance adjuster, you'd call all these things acts of God. And they are. This army is stopped, and it's not the Israeli Defense Force that stops it. Humanly, they couldn't. God's going to do something that he's done a few times in history, but he's going to actively intervene in history to stop this massive army. In fact, he ends up going to, and I'll jump to the end of chapter 39. He says in verse 21, as he described all that's going to happen, he says, I'll set my glory among the nations, and all the nations will see my judgment, which I've executed, and my hand which I laid on them, and the house of Israel will know I am the Lord their God from that day onward. Israel's going to look up and go, whoa, there is a God. And this begins a national revival of the nation Israel. That battle hasn't happened yet. We don't know when it's going to happen. But I do find it interesting that when you watch what's happening in the Middle East today, you see Russia trying to interject itself into the Middle East to replace the U.S., as a dominant influence. And they've decided to do so by choosing their partners carefully, especially Turkey and Iran, two of the major influencers, major powers in the Middle East itself, and Russia trying to get them aligned with Russia. Well, it's exactly what Ezekiel pictures is going to happen. So the nice thing is, as you watch what's taking place in the Middle East, don't be afraid of ISIS. Be cautious, but don't be afraid. Keep your eye on Russia, but don't let Russia keep you up at night either, because we know how the story's going to end.
Can I just ask your opinion?
Yes.
Do the Jewish people not read Ezekiel? And what are they thinking in Israel? Are they not reading and seeing what they're understanding what's coming?
I can't be too simplistic in an answer, because some do see it. Mm-hmm. Others say, well, he's picturing a metaphorical battle or something. They'll either look for a historical battle that remotely fits it, which there aren't any, but they'll try and find something. Or they'll say it's more metaphorical, more a picture of anti-evil coming against their people. But there are some who do see this and are keeping their eye on Russia and Iran in Turkey. But sadly, most of the Jewish people in Israel are secular, very much so, and the Bible is just an ancient book to them.
How does Islam see Gog and Magog? Do they reference it at all?
I don't remember it in the Quran at all, and I don't think they do reference it.
Okay. So what are they? Because they're looking for a big battle over there.
Yeah.
What are they looking for?
Well, it depends on. There's different groups, but like the Shiites, they're looking for the Mahdi, the Messiah. They think he was the seventh of their leaders. Went into occultation. He's hidden. He's going to reveal himself in the last days. Most of the Sunnis believe that Muhammad and Jesus are coming back in the end time. Jesus is going to tell everybody they should have become Muslims. And then there's the final judgment, and then we all go into paradise or into hell. So it's interesting, by the way, if you think, well, that sounds somewhat biblical. Well, Muhammad got most of his material from three places, the Jewish scriptures, the Christian church, and from the pagan religions around him. And you find kind of an amalgamation of the different stories from all of them. So there's a lot there that sounds familiar, and then it takes a left-hand turn when he added his own spin to it. Let's see, now, a few other questions. Yes, yes.
When this battle is coming to Israel, where is the U.S., or is that even
now? It's interesting. I'd answer it this way. When I look at this and the Book of Revelation, if we're looking toward the end times, I don't see the United States mentioned in prophecy. People try and find us in some obscure passages, but as I look at the overall tenor, we are a follower nation if we're around. Yeah. Now, the question is, how does that happen? Because the U.S. has been so dominant for so long. And a couple possibilities. If God's going to remove the church before this happens, our country could collapse very suddenly. Sadly, if I watch what's happening in our country economically, morally, everything else, 100 years ago, the greatest power on the face of the earth was Great Britain. And they're also ran now in terms of power. So given enough time, if this is still sometime in the future, the United States could just cease being the dominant influence that it's been. So I don't have a good answer, but the answer is, by the end, we're not the dominant power that's there. Yes? Now this is, I can't climb inside his mind to know. I don't know if he truly does understand. Oh, I shouldn't say that. I think on one level he's got to understand where Russia is, but there's just something that seems like, whether it's past business dealings, past relations, I just somehow think he feels like he could create the art of the deal and co-opt Russia and bring them on our side. So I don't know if he knows how truly... he knows emotionally how true the city of Russia could be.
So wouldn't he be given instructions and background
in
all this?
Oh, I guess he would. But again, yes, he filters it all through his own life experience. And I can't imagine that he can't realize how bad it is. And yet, somehow, I don't sense that he's...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, from my perspective, I'm it would be very helpful in the future if you were able to give us notes in advance. Maybe just when more people in the world. It's really hard to get it all to know.
You're right. And that talk about that machine gun rate, that's the northeastern Pennsylvania, isn't it?
But it's been fascinating, but
well,
I appreciate notes.
Thanks. Well, I'll mention that because maybe if you make, yes. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I was going to ask. I thought you were going to make a comment. I can give some of this to Kathy. The recording's been made, but I can also make a copy of the.
Charlie, tell them about your book.
The book.
Oh, yeah.
Buy the book.
There's a book called The Isis Christ.
Yeah.
I hate promoting books. They're never mentioned here. Now, in Revelation, there's the 100 million. Individuals. The question is that from the east, is it the Chinese or are they demonic words coming? And I'll leave that with Kathy to answer.
What was your question?
Oh, and that where's China in all this as well?
Yeah.
And it is interesting that apart from that one passage, they also seem to be they're missing.
Yeah.
By the way, one possibility with this over here. In Revelation, one of the most important things to realize is that at one point, one quarter of the world's population is decimated. Another spot, one third is decimated. That's 50% of the world's population, which now is running about 7 to 8 billion. 4 billion people being lost. It could very well be that the countries that are being lost could also be the West or China. And that's another possibility as to why we're not listening at end times. Truly frightening to realize how awful that period is going to be that's coming on the world. Sorry.
Oh, I was just curious, because it says there will be an unwalled and secure, and I know they're secure in ways, but I also read about the Psalm 83 verse, and that, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. I tend to take Psalm 83 as a poetic picture of battles that already have happened. So I don't see it being prophetic, but I know good and godly friends of mine do. But if it is future, it could be that even another battle would make Israel feel even more secure. Certainly, the past battles, they've always been able to take care of their enemies. I take this to be, Israel's going to feel pretty good. It's interesting, by the way, with this I close. You watch what Israel doing. They think somehow they can somehow manage Russia. Netanyahu has made more trips to Russia in the past year than he has to the United States. I mean, with Putin. And I think he's trying to build what he hopes is a friendly alliance there. I think he's trying to still become friendly to Turkey, which I think is a lost cause. And he's supporting Iran. But I somehow feel like Israel's going to feel secure enough, whether it's through their own armaments, their own technology and progress, that they're going to be caught unawares. What Ezekiel's picturing. And sadly, I'm reading a history of the 1973 war right now, the Yom Kippur War. 67, they had a great victory, and it made them feel a little too secure in 73. And so that could repeat itself as well. Oh, yes, what? Yes, and the U.S., actually, we didn't say that we stopped Turkey visas. They've retaliated by not issuing visas to citizens, and our relationship is heading toward a new low. That is still, if you interview someone on the street, that is what they're doing. The U.S. is responsible. And can I close our time in prayer and turn to Luke, but thank you for letting me have the privilege of being here. And Father, I thank you that your word is what we stand on. While we try and be students of what's happening around us in the world, we want to be informed by what you said is going to take place in the world. Help us to watch what's happening, but not be taken over by fear or panic. Give us the word of hope that we can share with those around us. Let them just know that you're in charge, you're in control, you're not up in heaven biting your nails, wondering what tomorrow holds. Remind us of that hope and help us to be an encouragement. We pray in Jesus' name.